This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. قل إن صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم بما كنتم فيه تختلفون وهو الذي جعلكم خلائف الأرض ورفع بعضكم فوق بعض درجات ليبلوكم فيما آتاكم إن ربك
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things, and no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land, and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The IAEA's Board of Governors passes an anti-Iran resolution submitted by the United States and its three European allies, accusing Tehran of lack of cooperation with the agency. Iran denounces the IAEA's resolution on its nuclear program as a political and unconstructive move, warning that Tehran's response will be, quote, firm and proportionate. Also ahead, China and Russia accused the United States of stoking tensions on the Korean Peninsula, calling for the easing of sanctions imposed on Pyongyang. Our top story this hour: the Board of Governors of the International Atomic Energy Agency passes an anti-Iran resolution submitted by the US and its three European allies, Britain, Germany and France. 30 state members voted in favor of the resolution. Russia and China opposed the anti-Iran resolution, while three countries abstained. The resolution accuses Iran of failing to explain uranium traces found at three undeclared sites. It also criticizes Tehran for insufficient cooperation with the UN nuclear agency. It calls on Iran to engage with the agency, quote, without delay. Iran had already rejected all allegations against the country. Tehran says such measures are in line with political moves to maintain maximum pressure on Iran. Earlier on Wednesday, Iran removed two IAEA's surveillance cameras, saying their activity was beyond its commitments under the safeguards agreement.
80% of surveillance cameras are operating under the safeguards of the IAEA. Iran remains committed to their operation and the devices will continue to work. Cameras installed beyond the safeguards obligations will be removed, and we have turned off a number of them. These cameras were put in place to record data to be provided to the IAEA. We won't provide the agency with such data anymore. We hope the nuclear watchdog changes its approach towards Iran. The IAEA cannot expect Iran to show extensive cooperation in response to the agency's non-cooperation.
The Atomic Energy Organization of Iran said the IAEA has not only been ungrateful for Iran's extensive cooperation, but has also considered the matter as a duty. Political commentator Keita Mansfield says the United States and Israel pursue politically motivated moves against Iran through the IAEA to pave the way for toughening of sanctions against the Islamic Republic.
the statement that went to the IAEA is very true, because as soon as mainstream media here in the United States picks this story up, which won't take long, it's rather rich, it's ironic, it's also a bit horrifying that the closest ally, the greatest ally of the U.S., which is Israel, wants to accuse Iran and try to turn this into a political move to further sanction Iran and try to hurt Iran and force it further and further out of the international community than it already has been. I find it then pretty ironic or hypocritical that Israel doesn't allow any oversight on their nuclear programs or really on their country or so-called country whatsoever.
Meanwhile, Iran, that is, says the countries that pushed for the adoption of an anti-Tehran resolution at the International Atomic Energy Agency are responsible for the consequences. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman made the remarks after the IAEA's Board of Governors passed the resolution. Saeed Khatibzadeh said Iran enjoys the world's most transparent, peaceful nuclear program. He added that by, quote, pushing a miscalculated resolution, the U.S. and its European allies put their agenda ahead of the IAEA's credibility. He warned that Iran's response to the resolution will be, quote, firm and proportionate. Iran's foreign ministry also denounced the resolution as a political, incorrect and unconstructive move. It said the anti-Iran resolution is based on false information provided to the agency by Israel. The ministry's statement said the adoption of the resolution will further undermine Iran's cooperation with the agency. It added that Iran has already taken retaliatory measures, including the installation of advanced centrifuges and turning off some of the agency's surveillance cameras. Tehran and New Delhi are set to take their relations to new heights, with the Iranian foreign minister now on a key trip to India. Hossein Amir Abdullahian has, in a tweet, said he explored the advancement of the two countries' strategic dialogue in his talks with Indian officials. He's in India to lay out a long-term roadmap for comprehensive cooperation. He's already sat down for talks with Prime Minister Narendra Modi and his Indian counterpart Subramaniam Jaishankar. Modi welcomed an invitation by President Ibrahim Raisi to visit Iran and likewise invited the Iranian president to visit India. Amir Abdullahian has also met with religious scholars and local figures, as well as Iranian business people and expatriates there. With a global food crisis looming, Russia says it is ready to help restart grain exports from Ukraine if Kiev cooperates.
To solve this problem, the only thing needed is for the Ukrainians to let vessels out of their ports, either by demining them or by making out safe corridors. Nothing more is required.
Lavrov was speaking after a meeting with the Turkish foreign minister in Ankara. He said Russia has already made the necessary commitments to ensure the safety of ships seeking to export grain from Ukraine. Russia and Turkey have agreed for Ukraine's grain to be shipped to Turkey and from there to the international market. Kiev earlier said it will not demine its waters as it will lead to more attacks from Russia. Ukraine is one of the biggest grain exporters in the world. The United Nations previously asked the two countries to start grain exports from Ukraine in order to ease a looming food crisis across the world. As fighting rages in the Donbass, particularly around the town of Severodonetsk, our correspondent went to the front line with Russian allied forces near another key Russian target.
We're on our way to the front line, outside the key Ukrainian stronghold of Adyevka. We pull up by the side of the road. It feels like no man's land.
The town is fortified well, but we're working on them, dismantling their dugouts with artillery. We're making passages in their defenses and going deeper. You can hear our volleys now.
Now, it's too dangerous to take the car along this road as it can be a target for anti-tank missiles fired from the Ukrainians, who are just about a kilometer in that direction, so we're going on foot. These fighters are from the Donbass, now loyal to Russia.
They've been fighting here against Ukrainian nationalists for 8 years. Trench warfare has returned once again to Europe. While some of the world's most advanced weapons slaughtering dozens of soldiers every day, the best defense remains underground. The living quarters, it's infested with kittens. The soldiers tell me that they have them at every outpost. They bring good luck, they say. More likely, much needed comfort in this brutal war.
Now, Adyevka is just over in that direction there. It's so well fortified that risking a frontal attack would cost so many lives, or indeed may not even be possible. That's why the Russian army is trying to encircle the Ukrainian army to the north of here. Then, after it does that, if it's able to do that, they plan to come down here and take Adyevka. Because to take Donbass, the whole of Donbass, it's major fortifications like this, which will have to be taken as well.
The remains of mortar shells. The trenches are doing their job. It's been some time since Russia has released its casualty figures, perhaps because the number might be hard for Russian people to swallow. But it's clear, with overwhelming air and artillery superiority, Russia is winning this war, where the fighting is fiercest. The next outpost, as promised, more kittens. Russian soldiers are being dehumanized by Ukrainian propaganda as monsters and orcs, leading to atrocities committed against Russian POWs. But it's clear these soldiers are very human indeed. Upon hearing I was British, one of the soldiers appealed to me to tell the truth about what was happening here to people back in the UK. I asked him what that truth was.
That there's a genocide of the Russian-speaking population going on here. The Ukrainians have been shelling our people for 8 years. They are trying to extinguish us. Tell them about this at least. At any moment, I can die here. But I am on my land and I will fight for it.
No doubt the Ukrainian soldiers in their trenches across the fields will have a very different version of the truth. Compromise is being achieved through war. Appropriately for this European conflict, poppies grow in the trenches. Many years from now, perhaps soldiers from both sides will be able to commemorate their fallen comrades together. But for now, the battle for the Donbass rages on. Jenny Miller, Donbass.
Elsewhere, debates in the European Parliament hear scathing criticism regarding the EU's role in the conflict between Russia and Ukraine. EU leaders are accused of not putting enough effort into a diplomatic solution. Jerome Hughes reports from Brussels.
The majority of the EU's 705 legislators do support the 27-nation bloc's handling of the Ukraine conflict, but a growing minority are very unhappy. On the issue of sanctions, the EU has been accused of double standards and hypocrisy.
C'est que quand la Russie attaque...
If Russia attacks Ukraine, there will be sanctions. When the US bombs Iraq, no sanctions. When Saudi Arabia bombs Yemen, no sanctions. When the EU destroys Libya, no sanctions. When Israel colonizes Palestine, no sanctions.
When dissenting voices in the European Parliament highlight Ukraine's history of corruption or the need for greater diplomatic efforts with Russia, they are often shut down.
Please, dear colleagues, try to do preventive diplomacy. As somebody who has gone through
you
the
have
war,
to come to
I know that war does not resolve anything. Thank you.
Mainly due to the conflict, energy and food prices continue to soar in the EU, placing enormous financial hardship on citizens. Despite this, it seems the focus remains fixed on weapons.
Our unprecedented military support package of 2 billion euros under the European peace facility helps Ukraine defend its population.
Some analysts blame NATO and the EU, directed by the United States, for provoking Russia into military action.
And now, for Ukraine, it's a very bad situation. For Russia also, and for Europe, it's a very bad situation.
Any of the 27 leaders in the EU can veto key policies in the European Council. For example, Hungary has been blocking a total ban on Russian oil imports. Some lawmakers want the veto option to be scrapped.
For 1 month, we put our indecisiveness out on full display. And what was the outcome? The perception that one member state won and the EU as a collective lost.
Other lawmakers disagree. They say it would be yet another example of the EU moving away from being a peace project and towards becoming a federalist superpower to benefit big business, including the arms industry. Jerome Hughes at the European Parliament, Brussels.
Now, a special committee has been launched at the US House of Representatives to investigate two recent mass shootings in the country. Families of the victims have now come to the court to testify. They are asking for stricter gun laws to save people's lives.
We seek a ban on assault rifles and high-capacity magazines. We understand that for some reason, to some people, to people with money, to people who fund political campaigns, that guns are more important than children.
They're dead because restrictions have been allowed to lapse. They're dead because there are no rules about where guns are kept, because no one is paying attention to who is buying them.
One of the shootings was carried out about 2 weeks ago at an elementary school in the state of Texas. It resulted in the death of 19 students and 2 school teachers. The other one killed 10 people in a supermarket in New York State. American politicians have been struggling to find common ground on how to reform gun laws in the United States. Last week, President Biden urged Congress to take action, despite gun safety advocates asking him to curb gun violence on his own. Elsewhere, hospitals across France were deeply impacted by a strike from medical personnel. French public health used to be ranked the best in the world, but austerity measures have caused a sharp decrease in the quality of care. Rami Mazahari has more from Paris.
With unions showing rare unity, hospitals were brought to a near halt across France due to a major strike. Since the Great Recession began, seemingly no group in France, other than the Yellow Vests, have protested more often than medical workers.
France's healthcare system was ranked number one in the world as recently as the year 2000 by the United Nations. However, its quality has plummeted following over a decade of banker bailouts and austerity cuts.
Neoliberal economics as applied to public healthcare has created too many complaints by medical workers to list. Frozen salaries, slashed budgets, overwork, closed hospitals, a lack of equipment, gutted morale, and much more. Thousands of medical workers who refused orders to get coronavirus vaccines haven't been reintegrated, even though corona restrictions have ended in France. And that has created even more labor problems.
C'est pire.
When you don't replace workers who retire or quit, then you're going to have longer wait times for critical medical care and worsened medical care overall. It's just gotten harder and harder to work at a hospital every year. We now have so few personnel that it feels like every single day is a strike day.
The degraded service has been dramatic and a common topic across France for years. The healthcare system is used by everybody, so politicians haven't been able to limit the negative impact to just the lower classes.
After 5 years of Macron, our healthcare system is in a state of catastrophe. We're seeing more and more people die from a lack of treatment. We have the money inside France already. Just tax the rich and businesses. Go after tax evasion and stop focusing public policy on the richest 20% of society. If we do that, then we'll have good public services and good health care.
The first round of legislative elections are less than a week away. The strike is a black eye for President Emmanuel Macron, just as he's trying to preserve his absolute majority in Parliament, which is crucial for him to be able to force through more neoliberal austerity measures. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Well, that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
vacation on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee. So recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday five things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, Thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
Perhaps a full boycott of the UK Book Festival is necessary, says Kit Clanderenberg, journalist, in an article published under the heading UK Book Festival Bows to Israeli Lobby. Stay tuned for more. The head of a major British cultural event has bowed to a smear campaign against Palestine solidarity activists. Opening on June 24th, the Bradford Literature Festival takes place in Northern England city, where many local people have protested against the Zionist regime's crimes. Simia Aslam, the festival's founder, has effectively sought to distance herself from public opinion. In October last year, she took part in an online conference organized by B'nai B'rith, a lobby group, an apologist for Israel's colonization of the West Bank and its attacks on Gaza. Aslam used the occasion to suggest that people moved by the plight of Palestinians have ulterior motives. Her comments accommodated efforts by B'nai B'rith and similar groups to conflate opposition to the Zionist regime's oppression of Palestinians with anti-Jewish bigotry. Although the Zionist regime has erected an apartheid system with support from Britain and the US, Aslam referred to conflicts that are going on, which she claimed can actually become sort of lightning rods for the issues. Aslam did not spell out what issues she meant. Yet her comments were clearly in response to a question about anti-Semitic actions, albeit without examples of such actions being cited. There is a lot that gets vested into, say, the Israel-Palestine conflict, and I don't think the understanding is always there when that is happening, she said, adding, I think a lot of emotions come into that. I am not sure those issues always have to do with that particular conflict itself. Material promoting the Bradford Festival claims it will bring an amazing array of world-class writers to the area. Some of the writers scheduled to appear at the 10-day event are firmly entrenched in the British establishment. Among them are Alistair Campbell, director of press for Tony Blair when he was Britain's prime minister. Campbell, according to the festival program, will be speaking about the big political moments of the past few decades, from Brexit to the pandemic. There is no mention of an arguably bigger political moment, the Anglo-American War against Iraq. That illegal invasion was enabled by an infamous dodgy dossier that Campbell played a major role in drafting. The dossier contained blatant lies about Iraq's weapons of mass destruction. In truth, those weapons did not exist. Campbell and Blair have never been brought to justice for selling a war based on lies. The sponsors of the Bradford Festival include the Aspen Institute UK. Headquartered in Washington, the Aspen Institute is closely associated with the Crown family. Lester Crown, an industrialist and real estate mogul, is a life trustee of the Institute and father of its current chair, James Crown. The Institute has a formal alliance with the Anti-Defamation League, a leading pro-Israel group in the U.S. Both organizations run a fellowship program ostensibly aimed at nurturing future leaders. Lester Crown, meanwhile, is a broad member of the Jerusalem Foundation, which undertakes construction work in East Al-Quds, where the Zionist regime is actively displacing Palestinians. He's also known to have raised funds for Friends of the IDF, a group that assists the Zionist regime's forces of occupation. Another sponsor of the Bradford Festival is the magazine Jewish Renaissance. David Dangor, the president of the magazine Jewish Renaissance, is a key player in the Exilert Foundation, supposedly a vehicle for charitable donations. It finances some of Britain's main pro-Israel groups as well, as the Henry Jackson Society, a neoconservative and anti-Muslim think tank, a website promoting the philanthropy of the Dangor family describes David as a strong believer in a strengthening UK-Israeli ties, who funds activities aimed at advancing the relationship. The Bradford Literature Festival was approached for comment but had not responded at the time of publication. The festival has been previously embroiled in controversy. In 2018, many Muslim artists withdrew from that year's lineup in protest. The protest was in response to revelations that organizers had received undisclosed funds from the UK Home Office's Building a Stronger Britain Together program, a counter-extremism initiative predominantly targeting Muslims. Just as discriminating against people based on their religion or ethnicity is responsible and reprehensible, Samia Aslam must be challenged over her catering to the pro-Israel lobby, which is dedicated to perpetuating an apartheid system. Perhaps a full boycott of the festival is necessary.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Operation Sinai. If I heard about it, if I heard so.
What was it?
I suggest we stop the interview here. What do you say? Why you want it? I'm built so, and I know exactly what I'm able to tell you, and I know exactly where I stop. And here I stop.
Why would you not be able to speak about Operation Sinai?
Signature and loyalty to my country.
On June 8, 1967, news spreads around the world which wasn't easy to believe. Unknown attackers target a U.S. military ship in the Mediterranean Sea. After World War II, this was the first time someone had dared to attack the U.S. military. April 30th, 1945, when an all-out rivalry broke out between the Western Allies and the USSR to conquer Berlin, soldiers of the Red Army reached the heart of Nazi Germany sooner than the Americans. With the fall of the city and Adolf Hitler committing suicide, the flames of the horrendous Second War in Europe burnt out. With all the death and destruction, as World War II was coming to an end, the two powerful conquerors could raise their flags on the mountains of soil and ashes and reorganize world order the way they wanted to. The Eastern powerhouse was the USSR, which had the dream of spreading the ideals of communism and saving the masses of the labor force from the oppression of capitalists. And on the other side, the wealthy Western powerhouse, meaning the U.S., was standing on the principles of using capital to create welfare. In the post-war modern era, both rivals tried very hard to win the competition and defeat their tenacious opponent. It was an all-out rivalry, which wasn't very friendly at all. An arms race, the strengthening of military forces and economies, and many other issues had created a battlefield between the two poles, which later became known as the Cold War. It was a time when the East and West would on the surface shake the hands of friendship, but in secret, point their weapons at each other. The Cold War and all its fearsome features took the U.S. and USSR to the brink of war on a number of occasions. But under the shadows of a scary invention, it never turned into an actual armed conflict. It was the dark clouds of nuclear fission and the devastating shadow of the atomic bomb which kept the flames of the Cold War from flaring up. The USSR was doing everything in its power to entice the masses toward communist ideals and turn governments into its allies. Of course, the USSR had to some extent succeeded, and communism was rapidly spreading around the world. Many big and small countries added the Red Star of Communism to their flag and stood with the Eastern camp. Communist ideology was rapidly spreading to weaker countries, and the formidable rival of the USSR had to do something to solve this problem. The U.S. wasn't idly sitting by either. With Truman's four-point program and Kennedy's Peace Corps, it tried to neutralize the USSR's plans.
This corps will be a pool of trained men sent overseas by the United States government or through private institutions and organizations to help foreign countries meet their urgent needs for skilled manpower. We will send Americans abroad who are qualified to do a job. It will not be easy. None of the men and women will be paid a salary. They will live at the same level as the citizens of the country which they're sent to, doing the same work, eating the same food, speaking the same language. We're going to put particular emphasis on those men and women who have skills in teaching, agriculture, and in health.
The fact is,
The U.S. wanted to create structural transformation and elevate welfare levels in weaker countries to create a bloc against the propaganda of the communists. Back then, the U.S. had no bigger goal than combating communism, so it did everything it could to win the hearts of the countries in need and remind them that the country that is truly worried about global welfare is the U.S., not the Soviet Union. But the battle of the Cold War powerhouses, like any other complicated game, had hidden layers which made the battle hotter and hotter. At a time like this, the center of gravity when it comes to global politics and energy, meaning the Middle East, wasn't spared of the game of choosing sides between the East and the West. The region has always been the battleground for global powers. The USSR got to the Middle East sooner than its rival and had won over the hearts of Arab leaders. The prime minister of the USSR was an ally of Gamal Abdel Nasser, Egypt's second president. With the help of Abdel Nasser's influence among Arabs in the region, the Soviets wanted to change the color of the map of the Middle East into the red communist star. The Soviets knew that the entrance gate of the Arab world was Egypt and Abdel Nasser. By raising the ideology of pan-Arabism to unite the Arab race, and of course his constant quarrels with its unwanted neighbor, Israel, Nasser had become the hero of Arabs. When Egypt, at the forefront of the Arab world, showed communism the green light, Syria also leaned towards the USSR. Syria had recently united with Egypt and established the United Arab Republic. A short while later, in May 1967, Anwar Sadat, the Speaker of the National Assembly of Egypt, went to Moscow to meet with Soviet Prime Minister Alexei Kosygin. That's where he was told that America's friend, meaning Israel, had gathered a large number of its forces on the Syrian border and the threat of an Israeli attack on the United Arab Republic was serious. The communists were forced to give this mischievous news to Egypt because they thought that military confrontation between the allies of the East and the West in the Middle East would lead to the victory of the Eastern Bloc.
We thought that политическом плане, даже если война закончится в ничью,
we believed a war could bring us political gains. Even a stalemate could bring us benefits. Egypt had our backing, both political and military. We thought their forces would demonstrate the benefits of Soviet support. So we were confident that the balance of power in the Middle East would be altered by a localized war.
When Gamal Abdel Nasser received word that Israeli forces had amassed on the Syrian border, he wasted no time. He immediately wrote to the UN and asked the organization to withdraw its peacekeeping forces, which had been stationed on the border of the neighboring countries from the previous war between Egypt and Israel. Nasser wanted to fill up the entire border Egypt had with this unwanted neighbor with his own military forces. It seemed the Soviets' plot for a war between the ideologies of the East and the West in the Middle East had really worked. Nasser took a further step, that putting his forces on standby and shut down the strategic straits of Tiran in the Gulf of Aqaba. The Straits of Tiran were the only waterway access Israel had with the eastern part of the world. The only passageway for the Israelis to import fuel had been shut down to the Zionists, and with this, war became inevitable.
Our armed forces are ready for war. The Gulf of Aqaba belongs to Egypt. There is no way that we will allow Israeli ships to pass through. The Jews are threatening war. We tell them hello and welcome. We are ready for war. But there is no way we will give up our rights to the Gulf of Aqaba.
The The USSR wanted to prove its friendship to Egypt and, of course, not be left behind from its rival, the US, in equipping its allies in the intelligence field. So, it got to work and laid cables on the seabed from the USSR to Egypt. The purpose was to be able to whisper in the ears of the Egyptians anytime it wanted. When the USSR realized that it's too late and the war will inevitably happen sooner or later, it ordered its naval forces in the Black Sea to move closer to Egypt's shores. Based on this order, 20 Soviet warships sailed to the east of the Mediterranean and were put on standby position. The USSR didn't want to leave its Arab allies alone in the war against Israel. But on the other front, the US ordered its 6th Fleet based in the Mediterranean to pull back from at least 100 miles from the danger zone. But one of the ships in the 6th Fleet didn't receive the order. As the entire fleet was pulling back, the USS Liberty had received orders to get closer to the Sinai shores. The Liberty was an unarmed naval ship with 45 powerful eavesdropping antennas, tens of advanced data processing and information analysis devices with language experts and professional analysts who were used to listen in on radio communications. The Liberty was getting closer to the crisis region to listen in on what was happening.
If it was broadcast on a radio wave, we could receive it at any frequency, low frequency, high frequency, medium frequency, very low frequency. If it was out there, we could receive it. If we were listening and we heard a signal and when we looked at it, we couldn't understand it, it was encrypted as well. We'd send it back to NSA and let them hit it with their computers.
The Liberty's confidential messages were radioed to the NSA, the U.S.'s top secret intelligence agency for the analysis and data processing of electric intelligence. On May 22, 1967, and before the beginning of a new mission in the Mediterranean Sea, the Liberty had slowly and steadily left the Norfolk port in the UK for the Guinea Gulf and the Abidjan port in the western shores of Africa. Its mission in this beautiful port in the country of the Ivory Coast was to listen in and find out whether things were going according to the US's liking or not.
We were sent around the world, wherever there might be a hot spot, to see if we could determine what was going on and if the United States desired any intervention of any sort.
The Liberty was leaving Abidjan port as Israeli forces were in military position and getting ready for action. Of course, the Egyptians were based in the Sinai Desert before them. The Israelis preferred for the issue to resolve without military action, because they weren't ready to fight and on two different fronts, from the southwest with Egypt and the north and east with Syria and Jordan.
I've been asked by my government to explore what these governments intend to do in order to reopen this international waterway to
what
a situation
do you want
of law.
What do the United States to do, sir?
Well, I've come here really to find out what the United States intends to do.
U.S. President Lyndon Johnson asked Israel not to start the war. This is exactly the same thing the USSR told its Arab ally, Egypt, to do. But Egypt had already taken the first step by closing the Straits of Tiran on Israeli ships. Things really got bad when other Arabs joined hands with Abdel Nasser and allied themselves with him in destroying Israel. King Hussein of Jordan was the first to sign a joint defensive alliance with Nasser and put his army under his orders. King Faisal of Saudi Arabia also went to meet with Nasser and pledged him his support. The U.S. wanted to know what secrets about the inevitable war in the Middle East the USSR was whispering in the ears of the Egyptians at any cost. These events were happening as the Liberty was in the Mediterranean and had reached the Rota naval station in Spain, so it could add three experts in Russian and Arabic to its crew. In the Israeli camp, the situation was in crisis mode. Egypt from the west, Jordan from the east, and Syria from the north are on standby, awaiting orders from Abdel Nasser to finish Israel off. Levi Eshkol, the Israeli prime minister, thought of a surprise attack as the only way to end the crisis and informed his new defense minister, Moshe Dayan, of his opinion. June 5, 1967, was chosen as the day to attack the Arabs. June 5th, 7 in the morning, 180 Israeli fighter jets flew towards Egypt. Only 12 fighter jets were left behind to defend the Israeli skies. Later, Egypt's military airport runways were bombed and 280 Egyptian military jets on the ground were the targets of Israeli rockets. The Egyptians were so overwhelmingly surprised that they didn't even find the time to start their jet engines.
In the limelight.
Hundreds of cops across the United States have been taught by individuals who espouse far-right extremist views, according to a new investigation that was published to sound the alarm on a burgeoning and unregulated private training industry. Please stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Kenny Stansiel, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Investigation Shows Hundreds of U.S. Cops Being Trained by Far-Right Extremists. Here's more. Hundreds of cops across the United States have been taught by individuals who espouse far-right extremist views, according to a new investigation that was published recently to sound the alarm on a burgeoning and unregulated private training industry. Reuters identified five law enforcement trainers who have been hired by police and sheriff's departments nationwide despite their support for right-wing militia groups, including the Oath Keepers, Proud Boys, and Three Percenters. The QAnon conspiracy, which baselessly claims that Democrats and Hollywood stars belong to a cabal of Satanists, pedophiles and cannibals, and former President Donald Trump's big lie that the 2020 election was stolen. Some use bigoted instructional materials that promote racism, misogyny, and many people endorse the constitutional sheriff philosophy, which maintains that country sheriffs should refuse to uphold any law they find unconstitutional. Reuters reported adherence to the constitutional sheriff movement considered the federal government a grave threat to U.S. citizens. They argue that local law enforcement is a higher authority with the power to countermand the decisions of legislatures, courts, and presidents. Richard Whitehead, one of dozens of active and retired police officers or trainers who were listed in a database of members of the Oath Keepers, has called for public executions of government officials he sees as disloyal to Trump, Reuters reported. In a 2020 social media post, he urged cops to disobey COVID-19 public health orders from tyrannical governors, adding, "We are on the brink of civil war." During his day job, the Idaho-based law enforcement consultant has taught at least 560 police officers and other public safety workers in 85 sessions in 12 states over the past 4 years, noted the news outlet, which analyzed public records from departments that hired him. He is one of the five police trainers identified by Reuters whose political commentary on social media has echoed extremist opinions or who have public ties to far-right figures, the news outlet added. They work for one or more of 35 training firms that advertised at least 10 police or public safety training sessions in 2021. Whitehead, Daryl Schneck, Adam Davis, Tim Kennedy, and Ryan Morris are tapping into a lucrative business opportunity that likely wouldn't exist if U.S. police officers were adequately prepared during their initial job training, Reuters reported. The lessons promoted in their private courses, meanwhile, might be less dangerous for civilians if states had more funding to set standards and provide oversight. As the news outlet explained, private trainers work in an unregulated industry that largely has evaded the heightened scrutiny of U.S. policing in recent years in the wake of high-profile police killings of civilians. Trainers like those identified by Reuters, a half dozen police training specialists say, highlight a lack of standards and oversight that allows instruction that can often exaggerate the threats that officers face, making them more likely to respond with excessive force in stressful situations. U.S. law enforcement officers receive far less initial training at police academies than their counterparts in comparable countries, said Arjun Sethi, a Georgetown University adjunct law professor and policing specialist. That opens immense commercial opportunities for private trainers to fill the void with ongoing training of active duty officers, often in a politicized manner that normalizes biased policing against Black people and other communities, he said. Private trainers typically advertise their courses to police and sheriff's departments, who often pay for their officers to take them. But individuals can also seek out and pay for courses on their own to satisfy government or department requirements for ongoing training. The courses vary widely in content and in price from hundreds to thousands of dollars per attendee. State-based oversight institutions, often called peace officer standards and training agencies, set requirements for police training, such as the types of classes and minimum teaching hours that officers must complete. But the institutions have little power in most states to influence course content or set standards for private police trainers, in part due to budget constraints, said Randy Strawberry, a former police officer. He saw unregulated police training as such a problem that in 2017, he founded the California-based Institute for Criminal Justice Training Reform. Cops who perceive a far-right trainer as authoritative and credible may end up adopting their ideology, said Strawberry, adding bad training is instilling bad behavior. According to a 2019 analysis of historical FBI data published in the journal Criminology and Public Policy, the number of line duty deaths has declined dramatically over the last 5 decades. Police deaths per 100,000 officers fell by 75% over the past half century, from 81 in 1970 to 20 in 2016. Deaths from felonies decreased even more than accidental deaths during that time. In light of such data showing declining dangers to officers, many training agencies long ago abandoned training that emphasized putting officers through simulations of threatening situations.